From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. North Korean state media today are calling it the meeting of the century. This weekend, President Trump walked beyond the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea and shook hands with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in North Korean territory.
This is my honor. I didn't really expect it. We were in Japan for the G20. We came over and I said, hey, I'm over here. I want to call up Chairman Kim. And we got to meet, and stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made. A lot of friendships have been made, and this has been in particular a great friendship.
President Trump announced the two leaders will restart nuclear disarmament talks. We're going to bring in Jim Walsh to the conversation now. He is Here and Now security analyst and a senior research associate with MIT's Security Studies Program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Lisa.
President Trump just became the first U.S. president to set foot in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which North Korea is known as. During the meeting, Trump told reporters that it represents tremendous progress. Does it?
Well, not yet. In some ways, I welcomed it. I think a lot of foreign policy professionals are going to be a bit cranky about the president sort of giving up a meeting without having gotten anything in return. Normally, that the other side does something, and then there's a meeting. But here's the context. After the failed summit in Hanoi, things were going downhill. People weren't meeting. They weren't talking. And the North was making sounds about resuming nuclear and missile testing at the beginning of the year. So things were heading in the wrong direction. This seems to have put a pause on that. Whether there's any real progress remains to be seen. But I'm glad. I'd rather them be talking than not talking.
Rather be talking than not be talking. President Yes. Trump has been talking to North Korea for quite some time now. Is the U.S. any safer because of that?
Well, yes, in part because he created a situation where it looked like we were headed towards war. He initiated that process by saying fire and fury at the UN General Security Council meeting, threatening to attack North Korea. That caused a crisis. It looked like we were headed for war. Then everything backed down. So, it's partly of his own doing, but we're safer than it was at that moment. I would say if they're not testing missiles and nuclear weapons, that's good. But we haven't made any progress since then.
Meaning North Korea still has the same amount of armaments that it did.
They're probably producing more nuclear weapons material since that first summit in Singapore.
Okay, so when it comes to the substance of the talks, the New York Times reported the administration is considering changing its ask from the North, that it might accept a promise from North Korea to stop growing its nuclear arsenal, which would acknowledge North Korea as a nuclear power. So National Security Advisor John Bolton wasn't there, apparently, when Trump crossed the border. That in and of itself might be significant. Mm. He tweeted today, Bolton did, neither the NSC staff nor I have discussed or heard of any desire to settle for a nuclear freeze by North Korea. Is the administration going to accept North Korea retaining nuclear weapons?
I think it will, because it really doesn't have any choice, at least in the near term. I think that's Bolton trying to do some bureaucratic fighting to get back in the game, because I think the Steve Biegun and the State Department team are probably closer to the president on this. Now, the traditional way you handle these sorts of things is first you have a freeze, then you have a rollback, then you have complete denuclearization. Nothing ever happens in a day. Even if we were all super serious and everyone wanted to get this done, which remains to be shown, it would still take 10 years. So, a freeze is sort of an accommodation to reality. The question is whether it's a freeze and everyone goes about their business or whether it's a freeze on the way to something more.
So there's a dichotomy here that at the same time, Donald Trump is making a big public display of diplomacy with North Korea, which the world considers a rogue state. His administration is pursuing a strategy of maximum pressure on Iran, which was indeed complying with the 2015 nuclear deal until Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of it. So what message is the U.S. sending overall when it comes to nuclear arms control?
We're incoherent. I don't know. North Korea has nuclear weapons. Iran doesn't. Iran was in a deal a year ago that was working where we had no tankers being attacked, where we had no drones being shot down, where we had no nuclear limits being busted through. He tore that up, and that's where we are today. Clearly worse off today than we were when he pulled out of that agreement. And on North Korea, I guess there's still some hope that this could go someplace.
Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh, and with MIT's Security Studies Program. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, now let's go to California, where as of today, July 1st, gun owners will be required to undergo a background check when they buy ammunition. Now, some states require a permit to buy or possess ammunition, but Governor Gavin Newsom, who's championed this bill for years, said last week that the new law will make California the first state in the country to screen buyers at the point of sale every time a purchase is made.
And that's a point of pride, and that should be a point of pride for every Californian. This does not deny people their right to purchase ammunition. Quite the contrary. It basically codifies what we're already doing for guns and makes it a similar process for ammunition.
Well, one result so far, California gun owners have been flocking to gun shops to stock up on ammunition before the law even went into effect, which, as we said, is today. Capitol Public Radio reporter Scott Rodd has been covering it all. And, Scott, this new law, a background check every time someone buys ammo and requires that all purchases be done in person. Why?
Well, the goal here is to ensure that people who are purchasing ammunition are doing it to load registered guns and legal guns. The goal behind this is to make sure that no one is getting their hands on ammunition who is essentially doing it for illicit means.
Well, and, by a horrible coincidence, there was a case recently of a police officer in California who was shot and killed with a so-called ghost gun. Tell us about that. Some are hoping this law will prevent that kind of gun.
Exactly. It was actually here in Sacramento just in recent days. A police officer fairly new to the force was responding to a domestic violence call, and she was shot by a suspect who had several guns that he had assembled himself, these so-called ghost guns. Officials have pointed to this new law and said background checks for ammunition could potentially stem incidents like this because it would require that the person who's purchasing it be checked out in terms of having a gun that is registered, that is legal. One component of the law requires that you can't just purchase ammunition and not have a gun. There needs to be a legal gun behind the purchase for it to go through.
Well, tell us more about this law and this thinking that this would be every time ammunition is purchased. How long will that take and what kind of databases will gun shops have to look at before they can hand over that ammunition?
So the Department of Justice will host this database, and it essentially, when someone goes in to purchase ammunition, they pay a $1 processing fee, and their name is processed through this database. The Department of Justice has said it should only take a couple of minutes, but gun shop owners and gun owners have expressed some concern about this. They've said the background check system that's already in place can take time. There are sometimes, bugs with it or it's difficult to work with. So the Department of Justice has said it should be seamless, but gun shop owners have said, their experience so far, or rather with background checks in the past, has been a little shaky.
Well, and there are gun shop owners like Norris Sweden, who are, as you said, speaking out. Here he is with ABC News.
Customers are purchasing because they don't want to deal, I'm going to be dead honest with you, with this BS. What is entirely going to happen from you going to cross state lines and picking it up from somewhere else?
Well, and what's the answer to that question? Or, the law also says you can't just, buy it from someone on the street. What's to stop somebody from making a private sale on the street or crossing state lines?
Well, a couple pieces to that. One, there was a gun shop owner that I spoke to who actually said gun owners may feel a little boxed in by this because if you go across state lines, especially to a state like Nevada, gun shop owners will be very hesitant to sell ammunition or guns to someone who is registered in California. Mm. As far as private sales go, that's also off the table. This has to come from a registered seller. There is, I wouldn't necessarily call it a loophole, but there is some wiggle room. You can give ammunition to someone. And the idea behind this is if, two people go out, if a father and son go out hunting and they want to share ammunition, the state realized that it would be a kind of a nightmare to try to enforce a law that wouldn't allow two individuals or several individuals to share ammunition in that fashion. So there is some wiggle room here. But as far as getting around it legally, that might be kind of tough.
Well, and what about blocking this law? There is a lawsuit. It's led by Kim Rode, who's an Olympian, who says she shoots thousands of shells every week trying to, get a seventh consecutive Olympic medal. Is there any sense that this is going to be blocked?
Well, there's definitely going to be a strong offensive to try to block this law. Already, there's been some success in the courts to have a piece of Proposition 63, which is what kickstarted this, that proposition in California. Part of it required that high-capacity magazines not be sold, to ban high-capacity magazines. That part of the proposition has been held up in the courts. So there's already been some success on this front. And so there's certainly going to be a strong offensive to try to block this background check for ammunition, for sure.
But meantime, today, if you're in California and you're going to buy ammunition, there will be a background check. Scott Rodd at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more. All built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
You may have noticed a new genre of op-eds in which very wealthy people call for a wealth tax to fight economic inequity. Eli Broad, the famous philanthropist, wrote one in the New York Times a few weeks ago, and he included the very thing he'd become known for, charitable giving, saying, in his case, giving to charter schools wasn't doing the trick. Abigail Disney has been vocal about her family company's pay structure. And then last week, she, George Soros, and 16 other well-known wealthy people wrote an open letter to the 2020 candidates asking for a wealth tax on the top 0.01%, in other words, on them. Well, Anan Ger Dardas has been cheering, sometimes needling them from the sidelines, in his writings and lectures at gatherings like the Aspen Institute. He's the author of Winners Take All. He first popularized this philosophy that philanthropy alone will never fully solve the world's problems. Anan Ger Dardas joins us now. And what was your reaction when you saw Eli Broad's piece in the Times? The headline, I'm in the 1%, please raise my taxes.
I was surprised and delighted because, you know, I have been beating a certain kind of drum that, you know, is at risk of being tiresome even to myself. At the heart of what I argued in Winners Take All is that rich and powerful people are very interested in solving the world's problems, but tend in our age to solve them in ways that reinforce their own wealth and power and the concentration of wealth and power and fail to fundamentally change the system. And one of the things that I advocate for is shifting from this kind of small do-gooding or giving to charter schools and this and that and actually fighting for system change. And so when you see a billionaire not only advocating for higher taxes, which we've seen Warren Buffett do and others do, but in this case, what was truly significant was an active working philanthropist whose name adorns many good causes and buildings saying, I have tried this, and I, as an ambitious, successful person, cannot see a way to move the needle on inequality and justice through philanthropy. The only way to do that is government and public policy. Let's stop making excuses and let's go in this new direction.
Well, for people who haven't read your book or heard your lectures, there's two things going on here. You're talking about changing the system to have impact, to actually have impact and make change. But also you describe this culture that's been created of the very elite gathering in different places and almost patting themselves on the back for their philanthropy, which in fact they get tax credits for. It's a kind of, you've described it at times as an image laundering and a feel-good thing that's more than off-putting. I mean, as you've said, it doesn't work. Can you describe that world that you kind of stumbled into?
Yeah, you know, I was briefly an Aspen Institute fellow, and we would go and meet a couple times a year in the mountains of Colorado, and we would talk about how to make the world a better place. And most of these people were business people. I was a kind of, you know, maybe the jester. They have some writers and artists kind of tagging along. And what really was striking to me is you had these people flying to Aspen talking about solving America's biggest problems. And as I started to get to know the people around the table from me or in the different gatherings and understand what they do in their day jobs, it started to become clear to me that many of these people belong to institutions that were the cause of America's biggest problems. And having been part of those institutions, you know, during most of the year, they would then fly to Aspen and seek to solve the problems that they were in many ways complicit in causing. And I began to be curious about that. So I began to research from the perspective of how is it that we live in this age in which rich and powerful people are constantly doing good, doing philanthropy. And this is real, by the way. They're not doing this stuff. They're doing this stuff. They're doing philanthropy. They're doing, you know, give one, get one shoes. You buy some Tom's shoes. Someone allegedly gets some shoes somewhere else. You buy iPhone cases. Bono promises he's going to help somebody. You know, every young person on a college campus has a social enterprise idea for turning recycled poop into coffee in Rwanda and connecting it to tote bag sales and comes with a free sock that helps an orphan. Like, it's everywhere. And yet, we live in this age of staggering wealth and income inequality in which America has increasingly become a casino that only works for the very few. And so how do you square these things? And I think the Broad op-ed is a dagger into the heart of the consensus that upheld this thing, which was that it's okay to make money ruthlessly, to lobby against government, to fight for low taxes, tax breaks, evade taxes, and then turn around and say, well, it's okay because you're solving it philanthropically. He called BS on that entire consensus, and I think he rendered it ridiculous in a way that someone like me as an outsider cannot, an insider billionaire saying, come on, guys, we are lying to people when we say that we can solve the biggest fundamental problem of the country right now. We are lying. Let's come into truth.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, I am going to have to carefully remove the hand that I've been biting that feeds me. We are, of course, a nonprofit. We are NPR, and we survive on people, you know, contributing and being philanthropic. I don't think you're saying to entirely get rid of philanthropy, but you're saying it doesn't help unless you change the existing financial structure. And Mr. Broad isn't the only one writing these kind of op-eds. His followed by about a week, one from Nick Hanauer, the venture capitalist who writes about how he spent much of his life donating to charter schools as well. He thought, we'll fix public schools with money and then fix inequality by fixing schools. Talk specifically about what is the one key here, the tumbler that you're talking about, a wealth tax, more tax on the wealthy, but then how does that become wages?
There's a handful of things. But I think first we have to get over an idea, which is for the last 30 or 40 years, we have to understand that we have been, as a society, on the receiving end of a war on the idea of public purpose, right? There was a time where words with the root private were bad things, like privation and deprived, and words with the root public, like republic, were good things, noble things, things we did together. And in the last 30, 40 years, that reversed, right? Private jet became good. You know, private
property.
Private property, private wing of a art gallery, private terminal at LAX, whatever. And public became bad. And this was a very concerted project, essentially by people who didn't want to have to pay extra taxes. Let's break this down very simply. And so they prosecuted this incredibly successful war on government. Jane Mayer in the book Dark Money chronicles how, frankly, five families on the right really led this turn, including the Koch brothers. And so when you say, how do you push back against that? A lot of people like to dismiss Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, radicals, socialists. You know, the reality is they are simply pushing for a restoration. So what are some of the policies that would get us there? A wealth tax is redistribution, right? First, you allow the economy to do whatever it does, and then you see some people get a lot of wealth, and you take some of their wealth and you reinvest it in public services. But those services might start to level the playing field going forward and change who's able to actually create wealth in the future. But you can also do things that are on pre-distribution side, right? Which is you have a $15 or $20 minimum wage, which means that you end the condition in this country of people working 40 hours a week and being hungry. It's policy, 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 policy.
We were looking at this when Abigail Disney wrote that excoriating op-ed when Walt Disney Company's chief executive, Robert Iger, got a pay package worth $65 million. And she said, no, more money has to go to the workers. There's a group called Resource Generation. This is an organization for people under 35 who are in the top 10% and don't think they should be, either because they inherited the money or because they have a corporate job they think pays them too much. They want to give their wealth away and also push for policies that make them traitors to their class. But when we were looking at this, we had a couple of colleagues saying, well, wait a second, they're still buying, you know, their third home in Vail. Are you saying that these people, in order to participate in this new thinking, do they also have to put on hair shirts? Can you still live as a wealthy person and call on other people to cut their salaries?
Look, I think what they need to do is more than symbolic gestures. And what I say to people is, give in a way, to use that phrase again that I love, give in a way that makes you a traitor to your class. And this is where I want to push Eli Broad and Abigail Disney and others. I think it's fantastic that these statements have been made. I really, really do. I think they're significant. I think they strip the clothes off a lot of the rich emperors of our time. And I think that's powerful. But here's the next step. And I'm happy to work with them on this. They should now redeploy their philanthropy to making these kinds of policies that are great for America but bad for rich people, make them happen. You could, for example, if you're Eli Broad, I would suggest deploying millions and millions of dollars toward movement building around tax justice, how you raise taxes in a way that works. Philanthropists could support that. Right now, those kinds of causes are starved because it may go without saying that causes that are sort of antithetical to rich people's interests are not usually favored by rich people. But if Eli Broad and Abigail Disney and some of these others are serious, what I suggest we think through together is how they can start actually giving money to causes that will make it impossible in the future for people to ever accumulate as much money as they did.
That's Anand Giridharadas. His book is Winners Take All, and he's commenting on what seems to be a movement, op-eds, and action from the very wealthy asking that the economic system be changed. Anand, thank you for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
So here's another example. In his op-ed, venture capitalist Nick Hanauer writes about how he donated for years to charter schools, then saw stats that show that schools, while important, account for only 20% of a student's ultimate success. His family income, the students, accounts for 60%. So Hanauer decided to try to change that family income, again, by shifting money from the very wealthy like himself to family wages.
We're following the major protests in Hong Kong today. Police are forcibly removing protesters from the legislative building after demonstrators broke in and spray-painted walls inside. The protesters want a controversial extradition bill scrapped completely and for Hong Kong's leader to step down. WBUR reporter Adrian Ma is in Hong Kong. He was overlooking a highway that had been overtaken by protesters when we reached him earlier today. We asked him to describe what he'd been seeing.
Well, it was sort of a changing picture throughout the day. I got to the area where protesters were gathering around 7 in the morning, and initially they were trying to disrupt a flag-raising ceremony that was related to this handing over holiday. It was basically a ceremony to commemorate the handing over of Hong Kong from the British to the Chinese. And as the ceremony was going on, there were some clashes between protesters and police. Some protesters who had sort of were being beaten back with batons and shields. There was tear gas in one instance. And sort of the mid-afternoon, it just kind of got into this tense waiting mode. There were lines of police and lines of protesters that were right against each other, a lot of yelling. And now that the sun is set, it is nighttime now. There are a lot of people here swarming around. And it is sort of like organized chaos right now.
We understand that the police who are there have, some of them have turned their cameras on the protesters themselves. The police have come under a lot of criticism. What kind of activity have you seen among the police and what is their presence like?
You know, there's so many people here that I think I would have a hard time finding the police. I mean, it's basically a sea of black. And by that, I mean people wearing black T-shirts and black pants. I will say that more than a couple of times throughout the day when I pulled out my camera to try and, you know, get some pictures of the scene, a protester would stop me and say, "Who are you with?" And they're really worried about police taking pictures and possibly being able to identify them later and arrest them. And that's why actually a lot of the protesters are wearing face masks.
So this shows you some of the distrust there. Are these people who would normally come out in protest? I mean, give us kind of a sketch of who you're seeing, who you're talking to. Are they young people, older people, families?
They are pretty overwhelmingly young people. I mean, they look to be mostly in their teens and 20s. And I sort of got a mix of responses when I asked them why they were here. A couple told me that they had participated in the Umbrella Movement protests back in 2014 when those protesters were demanding more democratic civil rights. I talked to another student who was actually just 17 years old, and she told me she graduated high school, and she's not very political usually, but she says that the more that she has sort of researched and learned about the relationship between China and Hong Kong, that she is becoming increasingly worried that at some point the rights that Hong Kongers currently enjoy will be increasingly curtailed. So she basically said, "I'm here today to protest because I'm not sure I'm going to have that right in the future."
Adrian Ma, reporter for WBUR in Boston. He is now in Hong Kong amidst the protesters there. Thank you very much, Adrian.
Thank you.
This beat is the bedrock of the percussion-heavy subgenre of funk known as go-go. And for many in Washington, it's the sound of D.C. Artists like Chuck Brown and Trouble Funk, whose song Pump Me Up you're hearing right now, got go-go going in the 70s. But as D.C. has gotten wealthier and in some neighborhoods more white, the future of go-go is uncertain, so much so that a city council member has offered up a bill that would make it the official soundtrack of D.C., and there's also a hashtag, Don't Mute DC. We'll find out more with Nico Hobson, founder and president of Go Win Media, the home of the online GoGo Radio Live. He joins us from DC. Hi, Nico.
Hello.
Nice to speak with you. And for those who have not had the pleasure of being on the dance floor to GoGo, just again, flesh it out. What is it?
GoGo music within itself is derived from the culture of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. And what it stems from is the grooves, the Afrocentric grooves that really encompasses the mind and the soul and the body that's hard to really understand it unless you are there in a live environment to take it in.
Well, and it's hard to not move to it. And that was the point. You know, Chuck Brown, who sadly died in 2012, he said that he just wanted, music that would just go and go.
Well, the whole purpose of it is when Chuck was initially a cover tune band, like a lot of the bands in the city were, and in the midst of him playing, instead of him stopping in between songs, he wanted to keep the beat moving, so to keep the people on the dance floor. Mm. In between, he told his drummer, who at the time was Sugarfoot Ricky Wellman, to keep the beat going. Thus, the term go-go, and it also was derived from the old Motown song, Going to a Go-Go by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles.
Well, let's listen, though, to a little Bustin' Loose, again, the late Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers. So, Nico, this is a sound from the dance floor, but it's a sound that's been, you know, pouring out of storefronts. This literally is a sound you can hear walking through D.C.
No ifs, ands, or buts about that. It reverberates through the, as we call it, the concrete jungle.
Well, we understand, though, that part of the recent upset came when I guess somebody called in a complaint against one of the storefronts that was playing this music, and the music was then turned off. This led to, you know, the hashtag Don't Mute DC. Lots of upset, the bill that would make this the official soundtrack. Your thoughts on this recent concern about somebody telling someone to shut down that music?
Well, let me give a little clarity on how the whole situation initiated. The storefront, which is called Central Communications, which is ran by a good friend of mine, Donald Campbell, not only sells go-go PA tapes or CDs, but it also sells mobile cell phones for T-Mobile. In that area right there, it really has gentrified. I say even 10 years ago, you would have never seen a Caucasian person walking through that area as often as you do now, mm-hmm. which for anybody that's from the old D.C. would be thoroughly surprised at now. And so the new people that came in put in a complaint to T-Mobile, and T-Mobile asked them to mute the music, so to speak. And so Don, he reached out to another friend of mine who I've worked with in the past, Ronald Moulton, and asked for some help, you know, for what he should do. So Ronald ended up galvanizing a few of his friends, and they came together, and a Howard University student ended up putting together a hashtag called Don't Mute DC in regards to the support of allowing Don and them to play their music freely as they have been for the last 25 years. And eventually, through the uprising, they garnered 80,000 signatures in the protest, which they was only looking for 10 initially.
Well, and that's just there's a lesson there. Watch out for terrific longtime community activists like Ron L. Moulton, who is the one who, you know, got out in public and had a kind of a press conference about this. He gets a student to get a hashtag, Don't Mute DC. And now you've got a bill pending. There's talk of building a museum. There's talk of archiving. Sounds like this one. Let's listen to a little more. This is Keep You Moving, Pure Elegance. So Nico Hobson, the music is now pouring out of Don Campbell's storefront. It's on the streets again. You've got the hashtag. You've also got the city conducting a census of the music community to try to, you know, figure out how to more effectively support go-go musicians. We talked about, you know, maybe one day a museum. Why is this so important? Why did this strike such a nerve? What's the importance of the go-go music at this time?
Well, if you went to Mexico, they have a culture that reverberates through everybody that's in that region. And so it's no different depending on what area you go in the United States. But the sound of go-go was born right here. And what makes go-go so special is that it is an all-encompassing music and style. And what I mean by that is it incorporates the audience. So the audience is actually part of the performance. So you have the lead talker who's basically in concert with the band and the audience, and the lead talker brings all three together in order to make what you know as is go-go. So people that are in go-go feel part of it. So go-go is not just music. Go-go is the people. Thus, you got that reaction.
Well, look, there was a time when go-go got a bad reputation because there were some, you know, violent clashes at concerts, and, you know, police would have a go-go report that listed upcoming concerts for, you know, the patrols. But, you know, that could have happened at any kind of concert. And what you're saying is that it's more than just a musical genre. It's something that's in the blood of the people who live in these neighborhoods. You know, it sounds to me like one of the messages that needs to go out is if you're going to move into neighborhoods that already have culture and custom, you know, maybe be more respectful of them or don't move there.
Or just take time out and figure out, you know, when you're moving into neighborhoods, figure out how you can get involved and find out what exactly is going on right here. Yeah, as the old saying says, try it, you'll like it. The old Mikey commercial, try it, you like it. You know, but people, you know, are stuck in their own ways and they don't want to take in new things. They feel, you know, and one thing when you're dealing with European attitudes is that sometimes they feel like, look, we run this. And so right now you're getting a pushback from the people that's right here in the D.C. Region. And what's great about it is they're coming together on one accord for a change.
Right. You know, and again, the bottom line, find out about your community. That's not just a radio blaring. There's something happening there. And it's some music that's beloved. Nico Hobson, founder and president of Go Win Media, thanks so much for talking to us about Go Go.
No problem. And I'd like to say one thing. Go Win Media is a multimedia hub that encompasses my two radio stations, internet radio stations, which is Win DC Radio and, of course, Go Go Radio Live, which is our mantra, our music, our culture.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
School's out for summer, but student safety is on the minds of educators across the country. In Kentucky, officials are planning to update their building security measures to meet a new state-mandated school safety law. As Liz Schlemmer from member station WFPL in Louisville reports, schools have about 3 years to get up to speed with the new regulations, no matter how much or how little the state gives them to pay for the changes.
When students walk into Frederick Douglass High in Lexington, they enter a set of double doors equipped with automatic locks, then funnel into the gym for a bag check. Here's student Ariana Lane giving a tour to superintendents from other Kentucky schools.
Right here, we'd have the metal detector set up. You would open your bag, all the pockets, and then somebody would look through your stuff. You'd walk through the metal detectors, kind of like an airport.
The metal detectors are only one part of her school's safety system. Like many large schools, this one has lots of doors, 54 exterior doors to be exact. But from 8:30 in the morning until school lets out, most of the doors have active alarms.
If you're inside and you want to get outside, if you press the door, it'll go off.
The only place a person can come or go without sounding an alarm is at the school's main office, where visitors have to use an intercom to enter, then sign in and get an ID. Frederick Douglass High was built in 2017, and it has the latest safety features now typical in new schools. But by July 2022, all Kentucky schools will have to have intercoms, cameras, automatic locks, and an ID system at their main entrances. And classroom doors will have to stay locked while class is in session. Those are just some of the mandates in the School Safety and Resiliency Act the Kentucky General Assembly passed this spring. Part one was getting it into law, which happened this year with bipartisan support, but no money attached.
Part two is going to be the funding and the implementation.
That's Eric Kennedy, lobbyist for the Kentucky School Boards Association, and he says funding is still up in the air. This summer, KSBA is working to educate school officials about the new safety law and to survey them to figure out what it will take for all schools to meet the mandates.
So once we go next session, I will help to meet with legislators and explain, here are the places that need more help than others, and therefore here's where we need you to step in and help us to implement these things.
While lawmakers work out funding during next year's budget session, schools are already planning for the new requirements. The most expensive proposal in the law will be getting enough counselors and psychologists in schools to meet national recommendations. But the law just makes that a goal. Schools are off the hook unless funding is provided. Building security is the most pressing mandate on schools.
The biggest lift for schools probably is going to be, in some places, it will be the electronic door locking system. Those can get expensive. I mean, even $10,000 for one door to have the camera intercom, that is pretty typical.
The automatic locks are for front doors, but classroom doors will also need regular locks. Kennedy says some schools built in the 70s, during an open floor plan fad, don't even have classroom doors.
And the trouble on every issue of funding in public education in Kentucky is always the same. The places that have the greatest need of funding as well.
Places like Dawson Springs Independent Schools, a district with just two schools in rural western Kentucky. Lenny Whalen is the superintendent. He's looking at having to retrofit locks on a lot of old classroom doors.
For a district my size, it may not be what a larger district would consider a tremendous amount of money. But on the flip side of that, if you had a larger district, they just have it on a much larger scale.
Many Kentucky schools are already compliant with the new requirements, but districts with older buildings or those that can't raise enough local revenue to pay for safety measures, like those at Frederick Douglass High, those districts will need help.
Several of our legislators have said that they're going to be really making a solid push to try to come up with some financial resources to help us implement some of this. So I'm looking forward to them stepping up and helping us do some of that as well, as they've already talked about.
State Senator Max Wise, who championed the law, says he thinks it could cost $35 million or more. But the survey is still out on that. Many lawmakers of both parties say they're committed to paying for safety upgrades so schools don't end up with unfunded mandates. That promise will be put to the test next legislative session. Student Ariana Lane says she feels safer with her school safety routine, but it comes at a cost for her too.
I wanted the normal high school experience of just walking in, being with your friends, and having fun. Like, my mom, she didn't have to wear a badge. They didn't have to get searched.
But she says this is normal for her now. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer in Louisville.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.